If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Picture a library and what do you see? Is it a local reading room full of beanbags and outdated computer desks? Or perhaps a more lavish, ornamental collection of a grand palace or university? Well, in their new book, The Library, A Fragile History, Andrew Pettigrew and Arthur de Verdeven chart the rich and ever-changing history of book collecting, discussing libraries great and small. Emily Bruffett spoke to them to find out more, and the first person you'll hear after Emily is Andrew.
Hello to you, Andrew and Arthur. It's a real pleasure to be chatting to you both today.
Very happy to be here.
Hi, Emily. Thanks.
So today we are going to be talking about your new book, The Library, A Fragile History. I wanted to start by asking you, what was your reason for writing this? What's so significant about studying the library over time?
Well, I think we wanted to write this because we've worked together before on different projects, and we found ourselves increasingly drawn to the history of book collecting as the centre of our work. We'd done a book on the book culture of the Dutch Republic in the 17th century, and we'd found libraries, and particularly personal collections, were absolutely at the heart of this story, and really mobilising and powering the book industry. So I think we said to ourselves, hold on, why has this story never been told? Because if you are looking for the archetypal library history, you'll find it's called something like the 100 most beautiful libraries in the world, or the destruction of libraries. It's about one thing or the other. It's either about great beauty or great loss. So we wanted to tell the everyday story of how the library movement changes in the 2,000 years since the Great Library of Alexandria. And it's that was what started us off on this, what's for us been a very exciting trail.
Yes, and what made this writing this book so enjoyable was the sheer diversity we encountered in the library world. Like Andrew says, so often it's a story of great buildings and great collections. And of course, there are many that do appear in our book. But this is not just a story of great national libraries or fantastic university collections like the Bodleian in Oxford. It's also a story of personal collecting. It's a story of small parish libraries, often founded by pious bequests from book collectors who wish to be memorialized for the future and leave a legacy through their collecting. It's a story of commercial ventures, like circulating libraries run by booksellers, where people could borrow fiction, which in the 18th and 19th centuries, when these libraries first came on the scene, was rarely accessioned by libraries. So we have a really rich array of different libraries that come into our story. And the other major theme we wanted to address, and the reason why we've called it A Fragile History in the subtitle, is because we recognize that, you know, most libraries aren't there to last. The concept of the library is a very human one, and one that we see reappearing with every generation. Every generation wishes to make the library in their own image and to stock it with the books that they value or that they wish to read. But, you know, most libraries that have existed through human history are no longer with us. And the ones that are still here are really rare surviving examples. And so it's this, the natural fragility, the cycle of building up, decline, dispersal, and reconstruction. That's really what stands at the heart of our history of the library.
When do we first start to see evidence of libraries existing in the historical record?
The first evidence we have of book collecting in libraries, I mean, it goes all the way back to the Theodoran's origins of literature and really the written text. So we're looking here already at the ancient Babylonian and Assyrian empires, libraries being constructed with clay tablets, and thereafter through papyrus scrolls, indeed. And that's often what many people will know something about. This is, of course, the Lost Library of Alexandria, which really throughout the library history story, other collectors and library builders have always looked to. Not that we necessarily know all that much about it, and indeed we should be careful that there's a lot of myth involved in this great library. But even today, we still see people harking back to these earliest library models. I mean, if you think of Google's great ambitions with digitizing books, or indeed Amazon's Alexa. It's not called Alexa for any reason. It's named after Alexandria. So, you know, so the library goes back a long way, and I think we can see in its earliest iterations, most of all, that libraries were meant as archival storehouses. Organizing and keeping information was, for Assyrian, Babylonian, Egyptian rulers, was the first motivation. And out of that, we slowly start to see a movement of growth that prioritizes scholarly collections and the library as a storehouse, not just of administrative information, but also of what you might call scholarly wisdom.
I think it's important to add, Emily, that for us, we're very generous in our definition of what constitutes a library. For us, a library is any collection of texts purposefully assembled. So it was quite possible in the 14th or 15th century when a manuscript library, before the invention of printing, might be 5, 10, 15 treasured books. But now, of course, so the library that the office I'm sitting in has a library. The room you're sitting in, I see, has a library. And so it's the collection which makes a library, not the building. And this is the absolutely critical point, I think, which suffuses our study, that libraries come and go. They're assembled, they're cherished, and then they're dispersed. Libraries, on the whole, don't last very long, partly because of the one critical fact which dominates library history is that no library is as precious to anyone beyond its first creator. So the emotional baggage that suffuses our libraries, our memories of where we found a book, how we collected them, how long we were looking for them, that has been a constant through history. Whereas the buildings can quite easily become empty shells because they don't have these personal connections. And it's very interesting if you look through a book of the 100 most beautiful libraries, how few reading desks there are in these places, how little facility they make for actually sitting and reading any of the books. It's the building that's the star, not the books. And we've tried to write a book in which it's the books that are the star, not the buildings.
Throughout the course of history, then, have we come to value books more or less?
I think we've come to value books differently, in that we now think nothing of having several hundred or several thousand books in a collection. Going back to the first days when books were papyrus scrolls, then in those days, the medium, papyrus, which is a form of reed found in the Nile Delta, the medium was actually quite cheap. But the sort of people who could afford an enslaved scribe to copy out the texts for them was inevitably only from the very highest levels of society. And that's what really characterizes the ownership of books right through to the invention of printing. that the privilege of owning books is one confined to the very rich. And this is even though we see one of the first great medium shift when you move from papyri, which are very susceptible to damp and where the raw material is only available in a very restricted area, to parchment, which is a medium that makes use of animal skins. And of course, animals are fairly ubiquitous, so you can have manufacture in all over Europe. In fact, my wife and I came across a papyrus factory up in Ross-shire in northern Scotland when we were on holiday this year, dating from the 8th or 9th century, which is an absolutely extraordinary piece of archaeology, which we went to see. But of course, it's more expensive medium. It's a very good medium, but it is expensive. And then, of course, we come to paper. And it's only in the paper era that the chance of collecting can move down the social scale with, first of all, people like lawyers and doctors and church ministers being able to put together collections of several hundred books, which a century before, in the manuscript era, would have been a royal collection. Mm.
Yes, and so, like Andrew has just said, you know, modes of production in the book world are incredibly important to shaping libraries and shaping book collections. But it's also, of course, you know, what people use those books for. And for much, when the invention of printing came along in the 15th century, this was a real sort of boon to professional people like scholars and lawyers and doctors, because they had this sense that they could access so many more texts. They could begin to fill their houses with texts that could sit on their shelves that they could enjoy. This also meant, of course, that the great collectors of the manuscript era, dukes and princes who previously had this almost a near monopoly on building great libraries, all of a sudden felt that their efforts were being outdone by lowly lawyers and merchants living in the same town. So this also meant that to them the concept of the library deteriorated as an elite object. So instead, you know, they turned to collecting very fine paintings or tapestries or, you know, gathering together a zoo of exotic animals. That was a fine alternative to busying yourself with all these books that all of a sudden everyone could access. And this issue of building or acquiring books for text versus an element of display, and whether that is for princely luster or indeed for scholarly display, that persists. And indeed, if we think to another key factor in the in change in book production and book supply in the 19th century, when we come onto the steam presses and the industrial presses that allow for the production of so many more quantities of books, and at the same time there are immense advances in mass literacy, there is a whole new market out there for texts. But just because you are literate and you enjoy literature doesn't mean you wish to build a library. And so much of the literature that was being enjoyed in the 19th century, newspapers, journals, what they called the penny dreadfuls, very cheap thrillers or westerns or romances that were being enjoyed by this great new readership, you know, they didn't make it into many public libraries, partially because they were more ephemeral than many great leather-bound books, but also because there was a sense that these were not the types of print that are proper to sit on the shelves of a library. And this too goes back, if we think of Thomas Bodley, the great founder of the Bodleian Library in Oxford, he did so much for the development of library culture, yet he also said that he didn't want idle books and riffraffs in his library, by which, in the early 17th century, he meant books in English.
I want to say a word about shelves, since the issue has come up, because we think of shelving as the absolutely obvious way of keeping books. And yet this isn't really anything more than an experimental technology when printing is invented in the 15th century. To this point, books had largely been kept in chests. And you kept your books, because they were valuable, in these chests with your other valuables, the contracts and charters and your ledger. So they were all in the chest together. And with a collection of 30 or 50 books. That was a very sensible method of storage. But this becomes impossible when people are having private collections of 300 or 500 books. Though chess don't go out of fashion immediately. The English philosopher John Locke, for instance, who went and set up his home in the House of Friends, who were perhaps a little bit unwilling to give him the idea of permanence. So his books remained in chests, and they didn't build him any shelves. But now, of course, the building of shelves can be much more expensive than the accumulation of books. If you built shelves in any ones of your rooms recently, you can see how eye-wateringly expensive this can be.
And indeed, I mean, if we go to some of those, if we go back to the beginning when Andrew was mentioning, you know, the world's most beautiful libraries, many libraries on that list will be great 18th century Baroque libraries in Germany, in Austria, in the modern Czech Republic, that were all entirely renovated and revitalized in the 18th century. But often here, indeed, it was more about making the shelves look beautiful rather than thinking about what books to place on them. And we know of instances, for example, of a monastery that had its entire book collection rebound in white vellum so that it would fit the new color scheme. And indeed, other libraries that had this beautiful, frescoed, decorated Baroque library, lots of hues of pink and blue and white. And then they found out that they had about a quantity of books to fill about a tenth of the new library space. So they had built a far greater library hall than what they actually owned. So this issue of, you know, people often complain online these days of, trends of color-coded libraries. And, you know, you can get interior design experts these days to create yourself a library. But this is something we've always been doing. It's just the latest iteration of that trend.
So I wanted to bring you back to the kind of the point of book collection. How has what has been chosen to be included within libraries, how has that changed over time? Obviously, there's an element of personal preference there. But could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. I mean, in the first age of print, collecting was still a serious business. Books were now very much more available, but they were still expensive. They were still a considered expenditure. So, for instance, the libraries of ministers of the church or professors tended to be theological. The libraries of lawyers tended to have a working collection of law books. And the books of doctors would, generally speaking, be books of medicine, and often Latin medicine in those days. And what you'll notice here is that the main collecting focus of this era is the old medieval faculties of the universities. In other words, we're still to some extent working within a structure of medieval learning. Now, it's perfectly possible that these collecting gentlemen and their families bought a few other books. But there actually wasn't that much recreational literature available in the first age of print. Some history, some poetry, a few medieval romances, but fiction really only comes into its own in the 18th century. And that's the real transformation which leads to the extraordinary expanse of personal collections, and that is fiction. And that only comes with a leisure society. You have to have time on your hands to be able to settle down with a nice book. Well, that transforms the market, but it also transforms the institutional library, because the traditional institutional libraries have no place for fiction. University collections are too serious. And actually, when the public libraries come along, they recognize a place for fiction, but they're very censorious about the sort of fiction that they'll be having. As Arthur said, no westerns, no blood and thunder, no gruesome murders. It must all be the public libraries were intended to educate the newly empowered working class industrial populations and to equip them for their role as participants in democracies. Therefore, public libraries bought with public money should be serious places. Now, of course, that actually didn't suit their imagined patrons all that well. So you have a totally separate structure of libraries to cater for people who want to read for recreation. These include some things known as the Tuppenny libraries. This might be the corner shop where you'd go round and buy a packet of cigarettes, but you'd also take away a book for tuppence, which you'd bring back next week. And if I was to tell you that until 1964, Boots the Chemist had a whole network of borrowing libraries as well. There's no sign of it now, sadly, but these were highly successful organizations and appealed to a certain strata of the population who didn't necessarily want to go to the public library, I think partly because they didn't want to meet their own housemaid or cook when they went, but they wanted to make their own choices discreetly in a sort of privileged space. So they'd go to Boots, they'd choose their book, and then the dust jacket would be removed before you took it away, so that the casual observer seeing it on your bedroom table would not necessarily know what you were reading. So all of these sort of social hierarchies feed into the history of collecting in a rather remarkable way.
And I think, as all these examples indicate, it just also shows you how political libraries are, and that libraries have always been a political space, because deciding if you're going to have a collection that's communal in any sort of way, that it's not just for your own enjoyment, that of your family, maybe close friends, you have to consider what books do I put in this library, and who do I want to let in? And this this has always troubled the library, and indeed often has caused the demise of institutional collections. We see this very well with the emergence of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century that leads to the dissolution and dispersal of many monastic libraries, of university libraries, of city libraries, because these are being cleansed of Catholic books. But the Protestants, of course, were great library builders themselves. And when their libraries were taken by Catholic forces, the reverse happened. One of the most fantastical libraries of the 16th and 17th centuries was the great ducal library at Heidelberg in Germany, the Bibliotheca Palatina, which was when Heidelberg was captured in the early 1620s. The entire library was carted off to the Vatican, sent by the Duke of Bavaria, who had conquered the town, as this sort of immense procession to say, look, we've taken this bastion of heretics, and we're now sending you all their books so you can pick what you like, and these books can't be used anymore by the Calvinists. And the Protestants did exactly the same. The Swedish Lutheran Swedish Empire in the 17th century, whenever it marched into a town, there were specific commissars there whose first job was to find out what libraries were in the town, and then to find all the books, crate them up, and ship them back to Sweden, where they would be neatly distributed among Swedish libraries. And that also makes the point that once, sort of confessional boundaries in Europe had solidified, there was a sense that libraries should have books that don't agree with your creed or confession, but you should, of course, restrict access to them. So in the great university library of Uppsala, there were two library halls in the same building. Both, you could only enter them from separate doors. And in one of them, you found all the good Lutheran books. Now, this was more easily accessible to the academic community. And the other one had all the Catholic and Calvinist books and was kept under strict lock and key. And this, of course, we may think, this is the 16th, 17th century. It's a long time ago. But these same debates have ripped through the library world in the 20th century, with the rise of totalitarian regimes. Indeed, with the with McCarthyism in the United States after the Second World War, the Cold War divide. We've seen it with segregation in American public libraries in the Jim Crow South. So questions of who should be allowed into a library, and this idea that, you know, we like to cherish this ideal that modern public libraries are there for everyone and should cater to all kinds of diverse literary tastes, it's actually often quite difficult to put that into practice and not cause offense or not attract some sort of criticism of how we should be regulating our libraries.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
But one of the interesting things that our research has revealed is that the books which survive in libraries through the centuries are not necessarily the books which had most influence at the time. Because the books which were most widely owned and most eagerly read were often quite cheap.
Could you perhaps tell us a little bit more about what challenges modern libraries face in doing this?
Well, I think the first challenge that libraries face and feel is a crisis of relevance. Now that we are all collectors, it's very hard for a library to keep up with this. The great age of the public library actually is vanishingly small. If you think of its functioning, flourishing goes from about 1885 to 1965. And since that point, the public libraries always face challenges. And the biggest of those challenges is the paperback. Paperbacks became very common from about 1935 onwards with the foundation of Penguin Books. And these were offering books for sixpence, which was the price of a packet of 20 cigarettes, whereas the new hardbacks would cost about 15 times that much. So instead of going along to the public library, waiting in line, getting yourself on a waiting list for the latest novel, you could go to the bookshop and buy a handful of Penguins. And what, of course, Alan Lane, the founder of Penguin, never really anticipated was that Penguins would become collectible. He thought of them very much as disposable books. Read it, pass it on to a friend. And indeed, some of the early Penguins from the wartime have the notice in, when you have finished this book, please take it to a local post office where it will be handed over to a soldier in our fighting forces. And it was anticipated that a book of that sort would never come back for the front. It would simply be discarded. Well, what we know is that Penguins, because of their careful color coding and their lovely uniforms and the jaunty penguin symbols, they became collectible very early. And public libraries really struggled to keep up with this. Eventually, they sort of made their peace with paperbacks. If you go into a branch library now, you'll find that romances, Mills and Boone or Harley Quinn, will make up quite a lot of the stock because their most valuable customers in terms of loyalty are people who read romances. But the problem is that most of the people who value libraries as cultural institutions don't use them. And when we talked when we were preparing this book to a lot of people who were campaigning to retain libraries threatened with closure in mostly in our cities. And when we asked them, did they use the libraries themselves? They very often say, no, they didn't, but they thought they should be preserved for other people. But the other people tend to use libraries for totally different purposes now. They want to use the computers there. They want to read the newspapers. They want to use the children's libraries for their small children, and they want to keep out of the cold. Now, all of those are very important social services, and branch librarians spend a lot of their working time now helping people on computers through difficult forms, like claiming universal credit. But it means that the space for books diminishes. The more computers you have, the more meeting space you put in, the more less room there is. And then, of course, there's also the challenge of digital, which is just one more thing that they have to cope with. But I'll let Arthur talk about that.
No, one of the great challenges is a challenge that has always faced public or institutional libraries. And in a way, they struggle quite a bit, actually, in societies that have an abundance of books, where it's very easy for people to access literature. You know, this day and age, and certainly with digital resources, we're all so used to being able to access almost everything. There is such a diverse world of literature out there that it's very difficult to have a public library that offers that same diversity, that same breadth to every single person who comes through the door. And I think that is a real challenge for librarians in trying to decide, you know, what do our most valued users want? And also this issue of novelty. You know, we're so gripped as a society by new things, by new sensations that come onto the market. So when there's a new bestseller or the new installment by a great author, we all want to have that at the same time. But public libraries really struggle to function that way, because if they only take one copy, then there will be a great waiting list for months and months for it. But if they buy 100 copies and everyone will borrow one, the books are then returned and they're left with 100 copies they need to store somewhere. Everyone's already read the new great bestseller. And this is something we see in a lot of smaller branch libraries in the UK, that, you know, the browsable stock that they have on offer in the library is often very small compared to what you may find in a bookshop. And indeed, here in St Andrews, our local public branch library has about 2,000 volumes that you can browse. Our local bookshop has 30,000. So this, and you know, this key experience of browsing is, I think, what so many people enjoy about libraries, and indeed what they enjoy about bookshops, because it allows them to find something new, something they hadn't expected, something they didn't know they wanted. And this is also the reason why bookshops are doing so well at the moment. It's because we cannot truly recreate this experience online. You know, we all use digital technologies to access text and rapidly extract information. And that's great. That's a real bonus. But it's also the reason why the internet or digital resources will not replace physical bookshops or the physical book. And I think also not the physical library. But the key thing is, you do need books for a library to be a library. All the services that the public library today provides, as Andrew just outlined, are great services, and they play an important part in modern society. But if you take the books away, you're left with another branch of the social services, not a library. And I think balancing that will be a big challenge.
Yes, I think the key problem facing the library today is anticipating the taste of the future. That's particularly difficult for libraries because to some extent they recognize a sort of role as the community's collective memory. So they do keep stuff which is not desired every day, but nevertheless, if they don't keep it, who will? And so there is a sort of necessity for that sort of historical role. But the problem is that all prediction about the future is wrong. I mean, I wrote a book about the transition from manuscript to print, the book in the Renaissance. And the thing that I actually wrote that when we were going through this transition from print to digital. And the thing that really struck me was that the boosters of print, the people who were saying, oh, this is a marvelous new invention, if they'd known what would have become of it, they wouldn't have been boosting it in the first place. And in the same way, the people who were saying digital, this is the most fabulous invention, they didn't anticipate online gambling would become one of the growth industries of the digital age. Why should they? But I don't think they'd have liked the idea. So the trouble is, we've not only got these problems of not knowing what the future holds, but the acceleration of new technology. With every era, all these changes go faster. And so what's the library to do? In the great national libraries, they're spending an awful lot of time thinking about how we can archive the inventions of the present. How are we going to archive digital culture? How are we going to know what to save of the millions and billions of tweets that happen every day. But the problem is, it's very easy for tomorrow's technology not to last. We've now been predicting, or people have been predicting, the death of the book now for the best part of a century. But the things which were to nudge it out of the way, like microfilm or the CD-ROM, they've both of them come and gone, and the book sails on. So there's a great danger, particularly at the upper echelons of the library profession, of trying to embrace the future too radically and finding out that you've embraced the wrong future.
What can your research, what can that tell us about the general feeling towards reading and the ownership of books throughout history?
I think throughout history, books have been valued. And in fact, in many eras of history, enormously valued. Some households would have only a single book, and it was often a secular prayer book called a Book of Hours. And that would never go into the chest, or it never go onto a shelf, because it would be consulted every day. It played a very important part in people's lives. When collecting became something which you could aspire to many, many books, books would be an important symbol of your status in society. I sit in my office and my students visit, and they always do me the credit of imagining that I've read all of the books in my office. And I never disabuse them of this, because it gives me authority before I even open my mouth. But one of the interesting things that our research has revealed is that the books which survive in libraries through the centuries are not necessarily the books which had most influence at the time. Because the books which were most widely owned and most eagerly read were often quite cheap. They were read intensively, and they were read to destruction. So they survive far less well rather than the sort of large tomes which were used for consultation, not reading. So the library remains that we have can sometimes give a rather misleading impression of the societies they came from. I think that's our major research contribution. Here at St. Andrews, we spend a lot of time trying to reconstruct the totality of the book world. And that means finding references in contemporary documents or auction catalogues, finding references to books of which there's not a single copy left in a library, but we know that because it was being published or it was being sold, that it actually existed. So this search for lost books, lost because we can't find them in any library, but we know they existed, that has been the cornerstone of the research contribution that we've added to this book.
I think one of the other things you really see in our history of libraries and collecting is that there is a general trend we've gone through, especially in over the last sort of five centuries, from a model of intensive reading. As Andrew said, you know, many people would only, if they had books, would only have a few books. They would go to the same texts over and over again. And indeed, in the very earliest Christian monasteries, to read scripture, and indeed also to copy scripture as an act of book production, is a spiritual act. And in being engrossed in a single text is a really important aspect of engaging with literature. And as more books are published, as books become easier to produce, and as literacy rates increase, I think we have gone to a model of much more discursive, broad reading, dipping in and out of particular texts. And that has also necessarily come with the ability for so many more people to own a great variety of books. If you can only own 10 books, you may make very considered purchases of what books you want to have in your house. And I think that's also a reason why we see that, you know, so many personal collections through history haven't survived, because the people inheriting them, a widow or children, family, heirs, you know, they haven't got the space for all these other books. They want to make a careful decision about what to have in their own home. But when books become much cheaper, many people can afford more books. So they fill their homes with them and are always running out of space. Now, of course, you can see this as a sort of degeneration of saying, you know, we're not enjoying text as much, we're not concentrating enough. And certainly, you know, the digital inventions have made attention spans, I think, much less. Because information seems so much more fleeting and instantly accessible, why do we need to remember as much? On the other hand, I see that, you know, this greater access of books, both in libraries, online, in personal homes, is also a good thing. And I'm reminded here of the great Italian philosopher and writer Umberto Eco, who died a few years ago. Very famous for writing The Name of the Rose, great thriller set, of course, in a library in medieval Italy. But Eco himself had a wonderful personal library, tens of thousands of books. In one interview late in his life, he said, "One of the things that everyone always asks me when they come to my house, they say, you know, wow, look at this library. Have you read all these books?" And he says, he always hated this question, because he would always say, "No, of course I haven't. Well, who do you think I am? I haven't read 40,000 books, but I have them, because it means that when I walk to my kitchen or to my living room, all of a sudden my eye falls upon something, and then I take it off the shelf and dip into it. And that's how I do my research. That's how I get new ideas." So I think there is a lot to be enjoyed about having lots of books on your shelves that you haven't read yet. Perhaps never will, but the possibility is there, and I think that's something to be cherished.
Yes, there are still, I think, limited laboratories of the intensive reading that Arthur is describing, and that is prisoner of war camps is one very good example. Between 1939 and 1945, many very active young people found themselves in a prolonged period of incarceration in prisoner of war camps, in the case of British and Commonwealth and American prisoners in Germany. And many of them turned to reading for the first time, read very widely, read enormous numbers of books, and some would come back and feel that their life had been transformed. And had they not been made a prisoner of war, they would never have undertaken a reading program of that type. But I think Arthur is right. In the hurry of our current lives, those forms of intensive reader are very much rarer. And I think the sort of experience of intensive reading Arthur has described from the first age of collecting, you see much more now in the way people rewatch films. Certainly the way my children used to rewatch films, they could take pleasure from any 10 minutes anywhere along a film that they knew very well and watch it over and over again. And I honestly don't think many people reread books to the same extent that they now rewatch films. So in a way, the focus of that sort of, if you like, comfort culture has shifted. When we're talking about the future of the libraries, there's a lot of doomsday scenarios. In fact, there was one rather good-natured piece of futurology called the Extinction Timetable, which in 2007 forecast that the last public library would close its doors in 2019. That's a very good example of the danger of prophecy, because here we are, well past 2019, and there are still 2.6 million libraries around the world. And of those, 400,000 are public libraries. And it's also worth saying that while we struggle and worry and argue about the future of public libraries in the West, in the global South, libraries are booming. So we're in a very strange situation that where we face these technological challenges, we face worries about redundancy, the cost of keeping a library service open. In other parts of the world, libraries are growing and more popular than ever before. So who knows? Perhaps in 10 years' time, we'll be able to say how the story ended. But I doubt it. I doubt it. I think the story of the libraries will continue to develop and fascinate for many years to come.
That was Andrew Pettigrew and Arthur de Verdeven. Their book, The Library, A Fragile History, is out now, published by Profile. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.